The North Carolina Reading Service presents for our blind and print-impaired listeners the following program. It's the Indie Week, and I'm John Federson reading the current issue, which is dated February the 9th of 2024. And we'll begin with a bulletin, a late-breaking story released today by Indie Week, and it was originally published online at the 9th Street Journal about Durham Public School Superintendent Pascal Mubenga. He has resigned. Bettina Umstead, who chairs the Durham School Board, announced the news last night. His academic record notwithstanding, Mubenga has come under fire recently following this pay dispute that has thrown the system into chaos, including days of protests and school closures. Umstead had mentioned that his accomplishments in improving the academic performance of Durham schools. He joined the district in 2017, and he'll receive close to $300,000 in severance pay. The announcement came after a three-hour closed session last night, Wednesday night. Before the meeting, the board had faced calls for Mubenga's dismissal over his handling of this dispute. In October last year, over 1,000 Durham Public Schools classified employees received pay raises, only to be informed by email in January that the district could not accommodate their raises and that they were being taken away. The employees, many of whom had upgraded their apartments and quit second jobs, were left dumbfounded. On Wednesday, the school board also released results of an internal review clarifying how the pay dispute came about. The report by the Tarrington Smith law firm elucidates that finance director Paul LeSueur was aware of the cost of the pay raises in February of 2023, yet did not inform the superintendent or the board of that information. The report states there was a lack of clarity and a failure of communication from finance about the true cost of the proposed changes to the salary schedule. The finance officer knew in February of last year the cost could rise from $10 to $20 million based on how years of service are calculated. That variability was never communicated to the board, and budget proposals consistently showed the cost as approximately $10 million. In November, Superintendent Mubenga became aware that the district had promised classified workers money it didn't have. He remained silent, telling two board members in December and advising the full board in January. The lack of clarity surrounding the situation has cost district nurses, cafeteria workers, instructional assistants, maintenance, and others much of their livelihood. Umstead said on Wednesday, "When we first initiated these changes to our salary schedule, our goal was clear: increase pay for our classified employees. We remain committed to achieving that goal and to provide all classified employees with clarity and certainty around their pay moving forward." Before the meeting, the Durham Association of Educators again held protests outside district headquarters. Sonia Talheimer, a participant in that demonstration and a DPS-certified staff member, is upset, worried, and stressed. Quote, "It's crucial to all of our schools that all of our staff are respected, both in how they are communicated with and the money they are paid." Talheimer hopes that at Thursday evening's meeting, that's tonight when I'm reading this to you, the board will listen and meet the DAE's demands, which include keeping February paychecks whole. She said, "This day, it doesn't feel like chaos. It just feels sad and hard. Classified folks are really upset, confused, and worried." DPS Deputy Superintendent Nicholas King was appointed by the board to serve in Mubenga's place until a provisional superintendent can be selected. His last day of work is February the 7th. We'll continue Durham and Wake County and some other election races, because early voting begins next week for the primary elections, which are going to take place on March the 5th. And several local races are on voters' ballots. In Durham, voters will select 5 county commissioners from a field of 11. Commissioner Heidi Carter is not running for re-election, but 4 other incumbents are all running to keep their seats. Durham Public Schools has 1 competitive at-large race and 3 candidates running unopposed. In Orange County, 1 county commissioner is running to keep her seat against 2 challengers in the Democratic primary, while 3 school board seats are up for election. And in Wake County, there is a Democratic primary and a Republican primary, sort of, for the County Board of Commissioners. Races for 4 district court judges' seats are also competitive. And finally, across the triangle, a handful of state House and Senate races have Democratic primaries. So our team of 4 writers and 1 editor met to make endorsements in these races. We considered a variety of factors, including individual skill sets, past experience in governing and civic life, volunteer experience, and other publicly available information. We also used much of our own reporting over the past year to inform these decisions. And here are our endorsements below. And there is also a handy clip-out guide if you get to a place where the paper is published, or you can see IndyWeek online. If you want even more information, check out the questionnaires that will be available on our website by next Wednesday, February the 14th. So now we will start down this list of offices, and we will list probably simply the names of and the status of the recommendations from IndyWeek. And again, these are not all the candidates, just the recommended ones that IndyWeek has provided in this issue. So we start with Durham County Board of Commissioners. It's a partisan primary, and voters elect 5 candidates at large. And the endorsements are Nida Alam, the first Muslim woman elected to public office in North Carolina. She is being endorsed for another term. Wendy Jacobs has also on the board, and we think that she has the institutional knowledge needed to carry the county forward. Michael Lee served as a member of the Board of Education up till 2022, and he oversaw the development of the Equity Affairs Department there. His blend of private and public sector experience would bring valuable skills to the board as it tackles major challenges like procuring affordable housing. So he's an endorsement. And Stephen Valentine, who has a long history of public service. And Michelle Burton built her career advocating for public education and was the president of the Durham Association of Educators Union up till 2023. And it's been a public school librarian. And there are other candidates listed, not the endorsed ones. Nimishina Burns, Brenda Howerton, Frederick Davis, Giovonia Lewis, Daryl Payton, and Renee Vaughn. Next, for Durham Public School Board of Education. This is nonpartisan election. Voters elect 1 candidate in District A, B, District 3, and 1 at large. District A, Wendell Tab is running unopposed, and he has our endorsement. Millicent Rogers in District B. Rogers is running opposed, and we endorse her for another term. District 3, Jessica Carda-Outen. She was appointed to the school board following the resignation of Matt Sears. She's running unopposed, and we support her bid for election to a full term, and then the at-large seat. Joy Harrell is an NC Central alumna and former public school music teacher. 13 years of classroom experience. She's dedicated her 2 decades-long career to working with young people as an educator and artist. And so we think Harrell will bring is the clear choice in this race. Her opponent, Atreus Good, is president of the Youth Mentoring Collaborative. There was an accusation of sexually harassing an 18-year-old coworker, and in 2013. The Indy reported on that allegation and other public records. but we endorse Joy Harrell. Now, the only competitive state legislative for Durham County voters this cycle is District 22, and they endorse Mike Woodard. Do we like that he supported a bill promoting charter schools? No. Do we approve of him voting to override Governor Cooper's veto? No. But when State Senator Woodard talks about having to work with Republicans on the legislature who have gerrymandered themselves into a supermajority for what looks like the rest of time, he makes a good point. A Democrat has to be able to work with the other side to make truly appalling pieces of legislation less bad and stand by those efforts. And so we don't always agree with Woodward's decision, but we think his absence from the Senate would be a loss, and we're endorsing him for another term. All right, let's move to Orange County. The Board of Commissioners is a partisan primary, and voters elect one candidate, and that's a candidate in District 2. Phyllis Porte Escott is a realtor and former vice chair of Orange County Democratic Party. Her six elected colleagues on the Board of Commissioners unanimously appointed her to a District 2 seat following Renee Price's election to the House. And she will serve in that seat through the rest of this year. And Adam Beeman, a business owner and seven-year member and current chair of Orange County's Planning Board. His experience in planning and zoning would be useful on the board, but with a platform focused on securing affordable housing, workforce development, and strengthening mental health services, we'd like to see what Porte Escott will do with a full term. Then the Orange County Board of Education, a nonpartisan election. Voters elect three candidates, and they're all at large. And the three recommendations from Indy Week, Carrie Doyle, we endorsed for another term, along with Jennifer Moore, who's endorsed for another term, Wendy Padilla, and we'd be pleased to see her as a newcomer on the board. And other candidates include Kevin Alston, a behavior interventionist, who stood out among the pack for his emphatic views. And as a relatively recent graduate, his sheer proximity to the issues that impact students today. We look forward to seeing his future work in the community. And we appreciate an incumbent Bonnie Hauser's attention to detail. But we don't believe she, Cindy Schreiner, or Michael Johnson share the commitment to equity that the other candidates do. So Wendy Padilla and Kevin Alston might be the recommendations. That's the way I read it here. Now, let's see. All right, now we are up to Wake County Board of Commissioners. It's a partisan primary in the District 5 Democratic primary and the District 6 Republican primary. And we're not making endorsements in District 6. And Darren Eustace, who will appear on the ballot in that race, says he has suspended his campaign. But so the Democratic primary in District 5, I guess, Tara Waters. Democrats will make a good choice whether they vote for Tara Waters or community activist DeQuanta Copeland. We ultimately came down in favor of Waters as the recipient of our endorsement. Wake County District Court Judges, a nonpartisan election. You elect judges in Districts 10A, Seat 3, 10C, Seat 3, 10D, Seat 5, and 10E, Seat 3. And here we go. 10A, Seat 3, no endorsement. We don't feel confident for either candidate. In Cindy Kenney, the incumbent, or Douglas Brown. 10C, Seat 3, Renee Jordan, longtime defense attorney, and is given the nod there by Indy Week. 10D, Seat 5, Kevin Boxberger, is a clear choice for retiring Judge Deborah Sasser's seat. Currently, he oversees the public defender's office for seven counties, including Wake. His opponent, Blair Williams, a state and civil attorney, is a Wake County Clerk of Superior Court. Boxberger gets the nod there. 10E, there's a tough call, they say, in 10E, where another defense attorney, Crystal Grimes, is challenging incumbent Eric Chass. He touts his experience. He's also passionate about reform. But in a court where progressive perspectives are desperately needed, Grimes is a breath of fresh air. She spent her entire 17-year career as a public defender, a true commitment to public service. So she gets the nod there in 10E. Then we have for the North Carolina Senate, District 13, no endorsement. It's a Republican primary. Vicky Harry and Scott Lassiter are the candidates. And District 14, a Democratic primary. Dan Blue, who happens to have been a long-time General Assembly on and off since 1981 and is now the Senate Minority Leader. We can't find out much information about Blue's opponent, Terry Passione. Regardless, we think Blue has earned another term. And the Democratic primary for the House District 33, Monica Johnson Hostler, a solid decade of service on the Board of Education in Wake County, where she's been a successful advocate for salary increases and student achievement beyond test scores. We think she will continue to serve Wake County in a state legislative role. Main opponent, Antoine Marshall, a former attorney for legal aid, and now owns his own law firm. Johnson Hostler's years of service and experience give her the edge. And there is a retired state employee, Deborah Dunston, also running in that primary. That's a long list. Indy Week, again, I'll remind you, does have this online on their online edition, which is free. And you can see other things like questionnaires sent to some of these candidates if you need more details, at least from Indy Week, all contained in a handy little packet. They also have something you could print out to take to the polls if you're planning to vote. And we hope that you're making a habit to vote in any event. All right, that's it for the election primary endorsements. Next, another surprise to me and a lot of people, I think, from the Raleigh City Council, in a move that harkens back to 2020 when, without public input or notice, the City Council voted to disband the city's 50-year-old Citizen Advisory Council structure, CAC. The council voted today to officially reinstate CACs. The vote was unanimous. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin said during the meeting that other members of the council did not make her privy to their plan to take a vote to restore them. Baldwin had led the 2020 vote to disband the CACs. The vote came in the final portion of the council's regularly scheduled Tuesday afternoon meeting. It was not on the official agenda, but during the report from the mayor and council members, Councilmember Christina Jones moved that the city council, quote, officially recognize and restore support for CACs and their larger overseeing body, Raleigh CAC. That's the RCAC. Jones said, when the community spends years advocating to be brought back into the fold, we have an obligation to respond clearly and definitively. I hope this motion will close a painful chapter in our history and open the door to building something that's going to outlive us all. CACs are community forums that were originally designed for in-person engagement to give residents opportunities to vote on issues scheduled to come before the council in an advisory capacity, including rezoning cases. Raleigh Mayor Clarence Leitner created the CA system in 1974 to bolster the city's applications for federal block grants. The city never received those grants, but CACs persisted as a feature of Raleigh's political landscape. Before they were disbanded, they required about 12 city staff members to help run them, and each CAC received a $1,000 allocation from the city. Since the 18 CACs were disbanded 4 years ago, 9 have continued to operate informally. The vote came with several stipulations. Jones asked that the city provide space for the CACs to use at city community centers for free, with access to live meeting technology such as Zoom and funding if needed. Finally, the Jones asked the city provide outreach to Raleigh residents to educate them about ways to participate in civic life. At the council's retreat back in January, members discussed the possibility of restoring CACs with financial and city staff support. Councilmember Jonathan Melton said Jones's motion encompassed issues that, quote, had consensus at the retreat, but added that the city should provide a, quote, menu of options for residents to engage online, in person, and an option for residents who are newcomers to civic engagement. But he said the new CAC system won't be the same as the old. Quote, I've had folks contacting me saying we're going to go back to the old way. There's no going back to the old way. But what we've learned is that there are pieces of the old way that are valuable for our new system. These neighborhood, face-to-face communications do not work for everyone, but for a lot of people, they do. I want to be as supportive as we can to everyone who wants to engage in the way they want to. Following the termination of those CACs, the City of Raleigh commissioned a year-long $70,000 study to look at ways to get residents involved with city government processes and initiatives. The city created an Office of Community Engagement as well as a 16-member Community Engagement Board charged with reviewing existing strategies for community engagement and recommending improvements. In a statement, Raleigh CAC leaders said those efforts haven't been enough and noted that our CAC's board have been in discussion with all members of the City Council to urge them to vote to restore CACs. The statement read, Raleigh is not slowing down. It's time for Raleigh's community engagement to catch up. Hopefully, very soon, every Raleigh resident will once again have an equal opportunity for community engagement, no matter where they live in Raleigh. Baldwin and disgraced former council member Sage Martin orchestrated that 2020 vote to disband CACs, according to the Indy's reporting at the time. Because the council had tried unsuccessfully in 2004 and 2015 to reform the CAC system, only to meet public backlash, they kept the planned vote to disband a secret from the public, as well as from council member and proponent David Cox, though other members of the council did inform media outlets, including Indy, ahead of that vote, under embargo. Before today's vote, Baldwin and Jones shared a testy exchange, Baldwin saying, I would just like to say, going forward, I think it would be considerate to share a motion with the full council before just surprising people making it at the table. I had no idea what was going to be proposed. Why did we bring this up in a formal motion? Jones responded that, with the vote, the community would understand the council was going to take real action. Quote, because we sat here for 4 years and did nothing. The reason that I am okay with how this happened today is because this is what you did to us 4 years ago, she said. All right, yet another election-related article from IndyWeek about Wake County's political landscape could change as Democrats and Republicans vie for seats on the Board of Commissioners. Policy changes may lie ahead for the board as three of the members, seven members, face election this year. While Democratic incumbent Susan Evans, the vice chair, is running unopposed, that doesn't mean we won't see political shifts. In District 5, community activist Daquanta Copeland is challenging the recent appointee, Tara Waters. Since both candidates are Democrats, the winner of the seat will be decided during this March 5th primary. In November, Republican Jacob Arthur will face the current board chair, Shanika Thomas, in District 6. Another Republican, Darren Eustace, unexpectedly dropped out of that primary race on January 26, leaving Arthur without competition for the GOP nomination. Arthur, who ran for school board in 2022, is campaigning on a platform of lowering taxes and spending, investing in law enforcement, and providing, quote, accountability in public school funding. He calls for Wake County schools, quote, prioritize academics, discipline, and teacher retention over DEI initiatives and liberal policies, which he says have hurt the school system. Wing Ning and Cheryl Caulfield, conservatives who sit on Wake County's Board of Education, both endorsed Arthur. Ning and Caulfield support Parents' Rights, a political movement that criticizes inclusive curricula related to race and LGBTQ issues, as well as calls for increased oversight of teachers. Well, now for the issues. As the county's population continues to grow rapidly, public schools have struggled to keep up with an equally fast-growing student population. Teacher pay, vacancies among support staff, and aging buildings have all been topics of conversation in local government meetings. Last year, the school board requested a $56 million budget increase from the Board of Commissioners, which they approved over the county manager's protests. The request included nearly $26 million for employee raises, a bold ask that Waters, then a school board member, said educators deserved. Housing also remains the top of mind for many voters this year as the real estate crunch continues. Property revaluations released in January show that many homes across Wake County have more than doubled in value since 2020, inciting fear among residents that property taxes will continue to shoot up. Buying a home is also still challenging as demand rises and supply falls. In District 5, which includes East Raleigh, it's a battle between two strong liberal candidates. Appointee Waters and community activist Copeland are equally qualified for the job of commissioner, says Wake County Democratic Chair Kevin Creech, who had a hand in nominating Waters to the board in January. Waters moved into her seat on the Board of Commissioners after 2 years on the Wake County School Board and has a background in education as a former employee of Wake Technical Community College. Currently, she's manager of the Volunteer Raleigh program, working to connect volunteers with city departments and local nonprofits. Waters says, in addition to supporting the students, I'm now able to support their families, their neighborhoods, their communities as a whole. It's a more holistic ability to make impact. Copeland, meanwhile, has more than 20 years of community service under her belt, along with a year-long gig as the county's first-ever community engagement coordinator for the housing department. She says the job is very intentional on connecting with the community, getting feedback, and designing things with community in mind. I'm the bridge with the crosswalk. Sometimes we get a bridge, sometimes we get a crosswalk, but it's not often we get both. I get to be both. Copeland has also served on the county's Board of Health and Human Services and currently runs 2B's Brains and Brothers, a nonprofit that, quote, supports and empowers youth in reaching their full potential, according to social media. Next topic, investment in education. Waters and Copeland have similar platforms but different priorities. Waters, who has a strong focus on education, says she hopes to demonstrate the need for more funding to state legislators by connecting them with teachers, students, and parents on the ground. Quote, building stronger relationships with members of the General Assembly to bring awareness to the growing needs our schools have is a top priority. It's one thing to make decisions when you are in an office, but once you have a chance to hear the stories of what our educators are facing, those shortfalls, tremendous investment is needed. She also hopes to reduce some of the racial disparities she sees in her district, in housing and health care, for example. She mentions caring for the area's growing senior population, as well as, quote, wraparound services for renters and homeowners to prevent eviction for people who are at risk of losing their homes. Waters supports the county's current approach to housing, which invests in a range of resources, including homeless shelters, supportive housing, restoration and repair programs, and protecting existing affordable housing. But she says she'd like to take a closer look at how funding from various federal programs and grants is being spent. As a commissioner, Waters wants to triage the needs of our community members, make sure we are not leaving anyone behind, she says. Also, give a voice to the unspoken needs of people who may not feel empowered to attend a commissioner's meeting. Copeland is taking another shot at public office this year after running for Raleigh mayor in 2022. Copeland came in third to incumbent Marianne Baldwin and fellow challenger Terrence Ruth, earning about 10% of the vote. But her Community First platform is still inspiring residents. Whether it's solving the housing crisis or tackling other big issues in Wake County, Copeland says the engagement portion is major. Actually speaking to the people we're advocating for so we can understand what their barriers are is key. Once you know the barriers, then you can create around the barriers. But if you don't live that life, or that's not your struggle, then it's hard to understand what the need is today. As someone who is in daily contact with community members, Copeland says the biggest need is undoubtedly housing. With thousands of people experiencing homelessness, the county simply needs more places to live. For those on the brink of homelessness, the timely access to resources and public programs is also a concern, she says. Our business, our faith-based community, our local nonprofits, they are the real first responders in every situation, she says, because when someone is experiencing economic disparities, social disparities, financial disparities, they go to the churches, the community leaders, the businesses, looking for help. If we can put them in a place to be a part of the solution as a first responder, then the pipeline doesn't have to be so strenuous or even more traumatizing. On education, Copeland is critical of the state's private school voucher program, saying public schools have to stay competitive, becoming just as appealing as private schools. That definitely takes funding, she adds, and while the state has tied commissioners' hands to some degree, they can help give local business, church, and nonprofits the capacity to contribute. Regardless of who wins, that new commissioner will bring a black woman's perspective to the board. Both candidates touched on the importance of reducing maternal and infant mortality rates for black families. In North Carolina, the black maternal mortality rate was 52.8 per 100,000 live births between 2016 and 2020. 52.8 per 100,000 live births. For white mothers, that rate 17.3. In District 6, which covers northwest Wake County up to Wake Forest and Falls Lake, voters are also facing a choice in November. If Republican Arthur beats Democrat Thomas, it would be the first time a member of the GOP has sat on the Board of Commissioners since 2014, says Jerry Cohen, a member of the Wake County Board of Elections. Quote, over the last 20 years, Wake County has moved from a sort of purplish to red county, to one of the most blue counties in the state if you're looking at statewide and federal election results. So there's been a significant change, especially in the last 15 years. Arthur has certainly highlighted that point in his campaign, attacking the current all-Democratic board. Quote, almost a decade of single-party rule on the board has resulted in taxes consistently rising, public safety worsening, and public schools declining. To avoid the perpetual decline seen in many counties in the country, Wake County needs a new voice for common sense policies. It is time for a change. Republicans will likely have an edge this election cycle due to a new law, HB 99, that Republican Representative Aaron Paré introduced in 2023. Under the law, which goes into effect this year, Wake County commissioners will be elected in a district-wide vote as opposed to the former county-wide vote. That means Republicans may have a stronger chance of getting elected in districts on the rural outskirts of the county, outside the liberal stronghold of Raleigh. In District 6, for example, about 49% of residents voted for Thomas's Republican opponent in 2020. Thomas won by a much closer margin in District 6 than in the county-wide contest, which she won with about 60% of the vote. Cohen declined to make predictions about the races currently on the ballot, but says under the new plan he, quote, suspects it's likely that one or two of the districts probably will elect Republican members. A long article now about a Democratic nomination for the Attorney General of the state. It tests how far progressive policies can take Satana DeBerry. When she was cut open for an emergency C-section, she felt a searing hole where the air of the operating room came right up against her insides. The regional anesthetic failed, so she still had full sensation in her abdomen. She recalls, "You're laying down on the table. It's almost like you've been crucified." She's talking about that moment nearly 20 years later from her office in Durham County Courthouse. Her voice has dropped to a whisper. Her eyes, typically locked in contact, are somewhere else. Memoir is a strong suit of DeBerry's. The 54-year-old district attorney secured her seat in 2018 and held on to it 4 years later, in large part by baring her soul to voters, delivering calls for prosecutorial reform and racial justice, alongside her own stories about vomiting after being pulled over by the police and clerking at overwhelmingly white law firms, where the partners didn't speak to her. Now, as she runs for the Democratic nomination for a North Carolina AG, her lived experience has come back into play. In a state that ranks poorly on reproductive rights and health care costs, in a country where maternal and infant mortality rates are horrifically high for black women, DeBerry wants you to know that she knows the stakes. She fought for her and her baby's life in that operating room. In the Attorney General's office, she says she'll fight for yours. Her primary opponent, U.S. Representative Jeff Jackson, wants you to know that he too knows the stakes. He fought in Afghanistan, after all, and while DeBerry's anecdote is being quietly conferred to a reporter who will write about it 2 months later, Jackson's is being spliced with boxing ring footage and disseminated instantaneously to 3.5 million TikTok followers who already want him to run for president. As far as name recognition goes, Jackson is about as formidable a candidate as one could encounter in a state primary. He ran for U.S. Senate in 2021, so voters statewide have already seen his name on the ballot. As part of that campaign, he did a 100-county tour, so many have met him too. And over the past few years, the 41-year-old has amassed a staggering social media following by posting videos about what's going on in politics, effectively captivating a Zoomer generation bereft of institutional trust. Chris Cooper, political science professor at Western Carolina, says he is, if nothing else, a master communicator, and elections are really about communication. DeBerry and Jackson are running to succeed Josh Stein, who's making a gubernatorial bid. The winner will likely go on to face U.S. Representative Dan Bishop, an attorney, and Freedom Caucus member, best known for authoring the so-called bathroom bill during his time in the North Carolina House. The Democratic establishment has thrown its support behind Jackson. The entire Democratic North Carolina congressional delegation and more than 30 state representatives have endorsed him, as well as a handful of prominent labor unions and PACs. The most recent campaign filings show that Jackson has received upward of $2 million in contributions total and has $1.8 million on hand. DeBerry, who is black and queer, has the support of the Durham PAC's Committee on the Affairs of Black People and People's Alliance, but outside county lines. She's only been endorsed by Orange County-based State Senator Greg Mayer, the LGBTQ Victory Fund, and a handful of other progressive political groups. She was trailing Jackson dramatically in campaign contributions at the end of January, reporting $43,000 raised and $30,000 on hand. Also running in the Democratic primary is Tim Dunn, a former U.S. Marine Corps prosecutor who now practices law in Fayetteville. Dunn has raised just over $11,000, but is in the hole by $21. Both Jackson and DeBerry have credentials. Jackson worked as an assistant DA in Gaston County and spent 8 years as a state senator. He's also a major in the Judge Advocate General Corps, the legal branch of the U.S. Army. DeBerry is in her sixth year as district attorney and has a legal background that includes working as a criminal defense attorney, serving as general counsel for the state health department, and leading a statewide coalition that fights for affordable housing. Cooper says they both have the kind of resume where it makes sense to run. But elections are about more than resumes, money, and name recognition, he says. Voters cast ballots for people they identify with. And black voters make up 43% of registered Democrats in North Carolina, more than any other demographic. There are more women than men in the state, too. North Carolina has never had an attorney general who isn't white and male. DeBerry was born in Hamlet, North Carolina, a railroad town in the Sandhills. Her parents were college-educated teachers. When she was 16, she spent a summer in North Carolina Governor's School, a residential program for gifted students, where she met a Princeton admissions officer who encouraged her to apply. She landed not only an acceptance, but a robust financial aid package. After Princeton, DeBerry went on to Duke Law School, then returned to her hometown to open a criminal defense practice. DeBerry was raised during a local economic crisis. Seaboard, the railroad line that Hamlet was built on, had consolidated and left half the town unemployed. And when she returned to practice law, she saw the fallout. Most of her clients were people she'd grown up around. She knew how tenuous their upbringings had been, and representing them rocked her perception of what it meant for someone to be a quote-unquote criminal, she said. It made it really clear to me how all these systems had failed them. The explosions of the carceral state in the 90s just put so many of them at risk. These were folks who didn't have the educational means to get out of town, or had mental health issues, or substance abuse issues, or families who were really poor. After a few years, she became demoralized. I was only pushing them back a little bit from the precipice. Their lives were so challenging. They were going to be back as a defendant or a victim. There wasn't much I could do. She left Hamlet for Durham in 2000 and spent the next phase of her career in positions that straddled law and housing, including a stint as general counsel for the Department of Health and Human Services. She also raised 3 daughters on her own and earned an MBA in health sector management from Duke. In 2017, while working as executive director for the North Carolina Housing Coalition, she was approached by Nia Wilson, executive director of the black woman-led Durham nonprofit Spirit House, who wanted her to run for DA. I thought it was a horrible idea, DeBerry says. I had not had great experiences with prosecutors. They never seemed to care about the challenges my clients were facing. I did not want to become that person. Wilson told her to open her eyes. Around the country, self-described progressive prosecutors who campaigned on criminal justice reform were getting elected left and right. in Chicago, Kim Fox had been voted into the top prosecutor seat after advocating for police accountability and reduced incarceration. In Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, who also has a criminal defense background, was on the brink of winning the DA seat after calling for an end to marijuana possession charges and cash bail. And Barry decided to give it a go, launching a campaign that framed reform as the route to a safer Durham. The DA's office had limited resources, she told voters. Instead of squandering those on low-level convictions, DeBerry said, let's use them to fight violent crime. During her candidacy, DeBerry was accused of plagiarizing from Krasner's website on her campaign website. She denied copying and pasting, but acknowledged borrowing heavily from Krasner, citing him as a model for progressive prosecutors, and later updated her website with changes. The message was received well in Durham, a city known for both progressive values and gun violence epidemic. DeBerry edged out Democratic incumbent Roger Echols by 8 points in the primary and sailed through the general. After being sworn in, she petitioned the court to waive unpaid traffic fines and fees for residents who lost their licenses years earlier, enabling thousands to become legal drivers again. She declined to prosecute nonviolent drug felonies and misdemeanors. With some exceptions, she stopped seeking cash bail. Pardon me. And she resurrected a pretrial release policy that, by the time she was up for re-election, had reduced Durham's jail population by 12%. DeBerry also locked people up. Between 2019 and 2022, her office cleared Durham's rape kit backlog and brought closure to several cases that had gone unresolved for years. Last month, her office received a $1.15 million federal grant from the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative to continue that work. Her office also closed 75% of homicide cases with a conviction, including the high-profile murders of three Muslim UNC Chapel Hill students. In line with her campaign promise of not pursuing capital punishment, DeBerry did not seek the death penalty in the UNC case. Her predecessor had initially made it a capital case, but sent the confessed killer to prison for life without parole. On everything she's done in office, DeBerry says one of her proudest accomplishments has been expanding support for victims and their families. She's done that in part by simply validating their experiences. For instance, the families of the UNC student who were killed viewed the triple homicide as a hate crime and, while to their dismay, federal authorities refused to make that designation, DeBerry described it that way, telling courtroom observers the defendant was, quote, a white man whose society had taught that his views were the only ones that mattered. She'd also try to support victims by way of transparency, she says. After being re-elected in 2022, she partnered with the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke for a year-long study on plea negotiations, meant to explain how and why prosecutors strike deals with defendants. And DeBerry has amped up the use of restorative justice programs, which seek to reduce recidivism in offenders and other catharsis to victims by bringing the two parties together to discuss the harm that was caused. DeBerry made history in using restorative justice in a homicide case, the first in North Carolina. That involved a Durham man charged with murdering his father. After a year, Donald Fields Jr. and his family made a, quote, repair agreement. As part of that agreement, he pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and was released from custody in June of 2022 with time served. If he violates any part of the repair agreement, he could face up to 10 years in prison. DeBerry says, victims just really want to know, why did you pick me and why did you do what you did? But more than a few victims have posed those same questions to DeBerry. She's come under fire for what critics described as a soft on crime approach that not only makes Durham less safe, but re-traumatizes victims and their families. The News and Observer reported that DeBerry's office had failed to notify victims in 2022 before greenlighting the prison sentence reductions of two convicted rapists and a convicted murderer. One of those victims was unaware that her rapist had been released until the NNO approached her about it. She told the reporter as though she felt that she'd been raped by the Durham DA's office. DeBerry issued a public apology and said she would investigate the oversight, but critics say there's a larger issue at play. DeBerry's office has approved motions for appropriate relief, as requests filed to correct errors that occurred during legal proceedings, and the mechanism by which prison sentences are often reduced at a higher rate than her predecessors. Some have argued this reflects leniency on letting offenders walk free. DeBerry says it's an indicator of her office's rigor. She says some of the cases we're resentencing are from times in which we know there was prosecutorial misconduct. This job is not about convicting people, it's about getting to the truth. She's also been criticized for the way her office goes about plea negotiations. Eugene Watt, whose 26-year-old brother Daniel was killed by a drunk driver in 2021, says the DA re-victimized his family by going behind their backs to offer the defendant, Gregory Coley, a plea deal with a drastically reduced charge, felony death by motor vehicle rather than second-degree murder. Coley was driving 143 miles an hour, had twice the legal alcohol limit when he crashed into a lift Daniel was riding in. A judge refused to entertain that plea deal in June of 2023, so the case is still pending. If the plea deal is accepted, Coley's projected sentence, originally 15 to 20 years, will drop to around 5. A court date for that ruling has not yet been set. Watt says, "Nothing can bring my brother back, but there's a number of years where at least it would feel like justice has been served." Watt is not opposed to criminal justice reform. He says he appreciates the philosophy that DeBerry promotes, but, quote, "if there were ever a case to be tough on, it's this one," he says. In interest of this one-hour broadcast, there's two more pages of Sutana DeBerry's in-depth article, and I would just encourage people who want to read this up to its conclusion to go to IndieWeek.com, and you'll find that story and lots of others that we never get to because of the time limitations. They're producing more material than I could get at in two sessions. And so let's look for my next article that I can. I have about 5 minutes left. All right, and we'll close this issue, having to leave several in the bag for hopefully reading later issues. After a controversy-filled 2 years in Gear Street space, Pioneers Durham will close its door, writes Sarah Edwards. A schismatic downtown Durham saga drew to a close on Tuesday. Pioneers Durham, an amalgam of church, coffee shop, market, and co-working space located inside the Hutchins showroom on Gear Street, announced it is shuttering. The last day of operations, the business, February 25th. The church has, quote, "not come to any decision to close," according to an email from Lopez Jackson, received after this article was published. Quote, "We have wrestled deeply with this decision, and while we have witnessed beautiful growth every month in the past 2 years, as we worked to keep up with the changing economic landscape downtown, it became clear that closing was the right decision," the organization wrote in an Instagram post. "We love what Pioneers is and was, and celebrate the years it was a place of peace for so many." As Indy reported in November of 2021, when the space first opened, Pioneers was led by Duke Divinity School graduate Sherry Lopez Jackson and received support from downtown's Trinity United Methodist Church. Upon opening, it almost immediately drew ire, due to its stance on gay marriage. Lopez Jackson told Indy in 2021 when asked about her decision not to marry gay couples, "It's a really tender question that needs to be handled relationally. I want to protect freedom. That's my priority, so why would I politically advocate for someone else's freedoms to be limited when freedoms are so essential to what it means to be a part of this country? I'm saying all that to say I don't always think there's a relationship between a theological conviction and a political conviction. That anti-LGBTQ stance is not singular. Other churches in Durham share it, and the issue has become a fault line dividing the progressive and conservative factions of the United Methodist Church. But Pioneers, with its shared business designation, neighboring proximity to a swath of avowedly queer businesses, and rose gold messaging tailored to affluent transplant, proved a perfect storm. The United Methodist Church, writ large, continues to struggle with the question of sexuality. By the end of the 23 calendar year, as the window for denominational disaffiliations closed, 5,600 of their 30,000 congregations had split, bringing the total number of exiting congregations to 7,700 over the past few years, an exodus representing churches intent on preserving a homophobic stance. In response to Pioneer Durham's presence on Geary Street over the past 2 years, rainbow flags have peppered the neighborhood and protesters have regularly congregated outside the showroom, holding signs like "Keep Gear Queer." In March of 22, a group of local UMC pastors also wrote an open letter to the denomination's regional leadership asking it to cut financial ties with Pioneers. In June of 22, Pioneers announced it was leaving the UMC and joining the Wesleyan Church, which adheres to much more conservative sexual doctrines. Daniel Jackson, Lopez Jackson's spouse, also announced he would be joining Pioneers as a co-pastor. "Through investing in redemptive enterprise and partnerships, we will be in a church that matters to our city to bring justice and hope to our neighbors in a tangible way," reads a mission statement on the church website. And that's going to close the time I have available. This broadcast will be available on the podcast for Indie Week, The Independent, after this show on Friday evening. John Feddersen for Indie Week, and wishing you a happy weekend, and we'll be back next week with another issue. So long.